We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the program a journalist and author of a number of great books, including Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, and Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. His newest book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. We're pleased to have Larry Tye back with us on Downtown.
Thanks for having me back on.
Well, it really is a wonderful book, so thoroughly researched. You had access to files and information that nobody's ever been able to utilize before in talking about Joe McCarthy. What drew you to his story?
Two things did. One was my last book was a biography of Bobby Kennedy. And when I interviewed twice Bobby's widow, Ethel Kennedy, she said something that I couldn't get out of my head. She said that Joe McCarthy might be a monster to much of America, but to Bobby and Ethel, he was just plain good fun. And if there are any two words that seemed jarring when you think of Joe McCarthy, it would be good fun. And the other is that I had signed up a week before the 2016 election to write a biography of Barack Obama. But the day after the election, two things were clear. One is that the Obama story would not become known until the end of Donald Trump's tenure. And the other is that the story of Joe McCarthy, which looked like a story of ancient history, was in fact the story of today.
Absolutely. And one of the things I found very interesting early in the book is when you say that McCarthy didn't even believe some of the things he was saying early on, but willed himself into becoming a true believer.
He did indeed. When he showed up for the speech that ended up launching his crusade and the whole McCarthyism movement, that was a speech in February of 1950 in Wheeling, West Virginia. He was enough of a cynic and enough of a guy desperate for an issue to grab onto that he actually had in his briefcase that night two speeches. One was a snoozer on national housing policy, and if he had given that speech, you and I wouldn't be talking about him 70 years later. And the other was a barn burner on alleged spies at the U.S. State Department. And that was a speech that he was looking at for the first time that night, really knew nothing about the issue, did not have the evidence that he said of spies in the State Department, but it put him on the page one of every newspaper in America, and he never looked back.
No, and as you point out in the book, even the names that he was using were old names, some of them that were even no longer working in the government. But it was never about the specifics with him. It was distracting people with the big noise, and then the number would always change, but it didn't matter. People weren't asking, are there communists in the government? They were asking, how many did he say today?
Exactly. So that is just what he did. And it's actually said, and it was said in humor, but it could have been as true given the spurious nature of all of his evidence. It was said that he stopped on his way to that speech in Wheeling for one of his trademark steaks or hamburgers, that he poured Heinz 57 sauce on it, and that was why one of the numbers he used in the subsequent week repeatedly was 57.
Fascinating, too, to learn about his military career. He picked up that nickname, Tail Gunner Joe, and people were dismissive of his military career. But you were able to get a lot of information, not just his military records, but from people who served with him. And you found out that when he was a Marine, he sought out action that he wasn't required to do for his job, but also managed to exaggerate his exploits and then even broke the law while campaigning for the Senate on active duty.
Yes. So that episode of his military service in the South Pacific during World War II shows two things. One, it shows that he was actually telling the truth, as you say, about volunteering for service that he didn't have to do. He was a safe land-based intelligence officer. He volunteered to fly various missions. He sometimes flew as a tail gunner. He came under enemy fire. We know that from his real-time handwritten diaries and from testimony of fellow soldiers there. And that shows that if you lie often enough when you're telling the truth, you're often not going to be believed. But he went on, as you say, when he was in the military to do things that were a clear violation of military regulations. And that was everything from sort of the mindless and harmless things like buying whiskey for his fellow Marines and doing peddling all kinds of contraband and making profit on that, to campaigning for his first campaign for U.S. Senate from his South Pacific island with enormous banners stretched across his truck and his tent saying McCarthy for Senate, even though that was a clear violation of military rules prohibiting anybody from using their service time to campaign. So it was Joe McCarthy not being able to resist, and yet there was that other side, the side that Ethel Kennedy talked about, that saw him as a legitimate war hero.
In that first campaign for the Senate, he really created in many ways the template for the next 70 years of the Republican Party and conservatism by painting a Wisconsin icon somehow as an Eastern elite.
Exactly. The icon was a guy who was as famous in Wisconsin, his family was, as the Kennedys were in Massachusetts. And it was a guy named Bob La Follette Jr. And this was a guy who had given up much of his life in serving his state. His father had done the same thing. His brother would become governor. And McCarthy managed to attack him as old and tired and a guy who was living not in Wisconsin, but in a mansion in Virginia. And some of that was had an element of truth. Much of it was outright lie. But Joe McCarthy was willing to campaign on the high road, on the low road, on whatever road would take him to where he wanted to be, which was to gain power and hold on to it.
We're talking with Larry Tye here on Downtown. He also, along with targeting suspected communists, targeted gays, homosexuals, and lesbians, and he said it was because they were particularly vulnerable to blackmail and foreign influence. But the irony, as you point out, is that Joe had a number of things that made him vulnerable.
Right. He was a gambler and had habits of drinking that would end up killing him. If anybody was vulnerable to the kinds of targeting that he was talking about in terms of Soviet agents realizing that this was a politician who they could blackmail, it was Joe McCarthy. And I think it was a fig leaf in terms of why he was going after gays. He was going after gays because they were vulnerable. He was going after, in many cases, Jews because they were vulnerable. And he was going after Reds because they made good copy, whether or not they were really Red, whether or not they were really working for the Soviet Union. And again, a joke that was told about him, I think, captures a whole lot of truth. It was said if he had been dropped into the middle of Red Square in Moscow on May Day, he wouldn't have been able to pick out a real communist.
He did get some help along the way from the FBI and more than likely from J. Edgar Hoover himself.
He did. So one of the things that was there in the closed files of all of his personal and professional papers, which his family opened up to me, was a series of records that were stamped top secret from the FBI, from the CIA, making clear the kinds of leaks he had. And J. Edgar Hoover was brilliant at leaking to Joe McCarthy when it looked like McCarthy could help Hoover in terms of making his case about communist spies and getting extra resources for the FBI. But when Eisenhower and others who were more powerful than McCarthy started turning on McCarthy, Hoover shut off the lever and stopped the leaks.
There are so many echoes that reach to the present day. Robert Taft, who is in many ways the leader of the Republican Party, didn't like what was happening. He wasn't pleased with McCarthy, but also realized that it might benefit the party.
He did indeed. So one of the first, in my role as a journalist years ago, I covered a young county commission chairman in Louisville, Kentucky, named Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell today reminds me so much of Robert Taft in terms of enabling the president when he knows better. Taft told his friends that McCarthy was reckless and couldn't be trusted and would end up bringing down the party. McConnell has been quoted as saying similar things to his confidants, and yet both of them continue to support the demagogue because it serves their narrow interests at the time.
so many parallels to the present day and Donald Trump. And you point out that, like Donald Trump, Joe McCarthy understood how to use and manipulate the media to get what he wanted.
He did from the very beginning. He did when he went and gave that speech that we were talking about earlier in Wheeling, West Virginia, the one where he named all the, or he held the list that he said contained the names of these spies in the State Department. And it wasn't accidental that he chose a place like Wheeling, West Virginia, to unleash that evidence. He knew that there would be only two reporters there covering his speech, one for the local paper called the Wheeling Intelligencer, and the other a local Associated Press reporter. So he knew they wouldn't know who to call at the State Department for comment for the next day's story. He also knew if he gave the speech as a dinner speech, there wouldn't be time to get comment. He knew perfectly how to manipulate the press. And he ended up with his charges every day on page one, and it was on page 24 the following day that there would be the rebuttals. And he knew that nobody would pay attention to the rebuttals. So he charmed the press when he had to, and like the current occupant of the White House, he intimidated and attacked the press when the news was bad.
And much like that current occupant, did he also display the classic characteristics of a bully?
Absolutely the classic characteristics of a bully. And it was not accidental that you and I are making this connection between McCarthy and Trump. It's not just that the actions look alike. It is that Joe McCarthy's protege, a brilliant and arrogant young lawyer from New York named Roy Cohn, 50 years later, was Donald Trump's tutor when he was entering the cutthroat world of New York real estate. Roy Cohn passed on directly all the lessons from Joe McCarthy to Donald Trump. And when Trump has been in trouble the last 3.5 years, he has said repeatedly, "I wish I had a Roy Cohn by my side." And I think what he's really saying, only it would be too controversial to say it, is I wish I had a Joe McCarthy by my side.
Last time you were on and we talked about your wonderful book on Bobby Kennedy, you talked about Kennedy's work with McCarthy, a job that was really set up by a dad, Joe Kennedy. And it was Roy Cohn that really drove Bobby Kennedy away from McCarthy. He liked Joe, the family liked Joe, but Kennedy and Cohn never got along.
Yes, so Bobby Kennedy defended and befriended Joe McCarthy for the rest of McCarthy's life and never had problems with McCarthy's anti-communism. He did have problems with Roy Cohn. And the irony is, had McCarthy not picked Roy Cohn to run his staff, the guy he would have picked is Bobby Kennedy. And we can only dream how Joe McCarthy might have been different if instead of Roy Cohn whispering in his ear and reinforcing every bad instinct in McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy had been there whispering different things.
Well, if you got on the bad side of Joe McCarthy, he could be ruthless. And is it safe to say that Millard Tidings of Maryland was the first to learn that the hard way?
Yes, it's safe to say that he pulled out his notorious battering ram and he went after Millard Tidings. He was a powerful senator from Maryland. He had taken on Joe McCarthy, calling him a fraud and a hoax. And the next election, McCarthy recruited a know-nothing Republican to run against him, got him financing, lent him McCarthy's bag of dirty tricks. Tidings went down to defeat, and a clarion message went out to Democrats and to Republicans, take on Joe McCarthy at your own risk.
And very few were willing to do that until, well, 70 years ago, last month, when our own Senator Margaret Chase Smith gave her Declaration of Conscience speech, and that was surprising in so many ways. She had not been known for speaking out a lot in her time in the Senate or the House. Her trademark was the red rose and showing up to cast her vote every day. What led her to take that stand?
What led her was this moment of courage. Basically, as she said in her speech, McCarthy violated every sense of what was right and what was American. And it was called the Declaration of Conscience. She delivered it with six fellow moderate Republicans. And McCarthy, in classic name-calling fashion that, again, might ring a bell today, dubbed Smith and her collaborators Snow White and the Six Dwarfs. And he went after her the next time she was up for election. She won easily, but not by as big a margin as she had before. And I think the message to the enablers today in the U.S. Senate who support the president even when they think he's wrong, The lesson is, history will judge you. Margaret Chase Smith, if she is remembered for any single thing today, it is having the courage to stand up to Joe McCarthy.
Well, yes, and we often say around here that Susan Collins has talked throughout her career of being someone who has looked up to Margaret Chase Smith, but we haven't seen a lot of Smith-like behavior in recent years from Senator Collins.
So it's ironic because Senator Collins chaired the same subcommittee, the same powerful subcommittee, permanent subcommittee on investigations that Joe McCarthy did. Collins had the courage about 10 years ago to release all the transcripts of McCarthy's closed-door hearings that showed just what kind of bully she is. Collins has said repeatedly throughout her career that Margaret Chase Smith is her role model, and yet she wavers in terms of having that Smith kind of courage to take on the bully in her own party.
We're talking with Larry Tye about his terrific book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. One of the things that I learned from the book is that it was not just Edward R. Murrow and the people at CBS that were going after McCarthy. There were others in the media pursuing that story.
So that's absolutely true. History always gives us a simple version of things. And in a very good and well-known movie called Good Night and Good Luck, Edward R. Murrow was proclaimed the McCarthy Slayer. And he, in fact, had some incredibly hard-hitting broadcasts on McCarthy, but they were very late in the game. And Murrow himself admitted that he was late to come around and had the courage to take on Joe McCarthy. It was much less well-known people, and especially America's most famous and well-read columnist of that era, a guy named Drew Pearson, who took on McCarthy early, who for his efforts in attacking McCarthy, he was pummeled by McCarthy when they ran into one another at the cloakroom of a supper club, and he might have been really beaten badly if a peacemaker, a Quaker peacemaker that we came to know later, Richard Nixon, hadn't stepped in between the two. And more damaging even to Pearson, McCarthy went after his sponsor and convinced the sponsor to drop the sponsorship of Pearson's radio broadcast. So again, like he did with Millard Tidings in the political realm, McCarthy was telling the press, you take me on and you will pay.
He had taken on the military before when he went after George Marshall, but the Army McCarthy hearings proved to be his undoing. Was that a bridge too far, particularly with Dwight Eisenhower in the White House to attack the military?
So I would call it two things. One is a bridge too far or an enemy too big to bully, and the other is an object lesson again for today's big bully. And the object lesson is when you take on the military the way the president has recently in his photo op across from the White House, when he used the military in a way the military regretted having been used, that the military may be the one force in American life, the most democratic in many ways force in American life, that you take on at your own risk. And even when you think you have all the power, Joe McCarthy started 1954 at the beginning of the Army McCarthy hearings with a 50% favorability. He looked invulnerable. By the end of those hearings, just 6 months later, his popularity had dropped to 34%, and the gig was up.
One of the important things you learned, Larry, in your research was the extent of McCarthy's medical issues, and particularly his addiction to alcohol. And you write about how it affected his personal life, it affected his professional life, that hearings held in the afternoon were often different than hearings held in the morning, and ultimately that would lead to his death.
It did. So the one of the sets of files that were made available to me were all of his medical records from Bethesda Naval Hospital, and they documented in stunning detail his increasing consumption of alcohol to the point where he was drinking a fifth a day. And in the end, it was not what the coroner told us, which was acute hepatitis, that was his cause of death. It was the effects of alcohol killing him. And it was tragic, and it was bad all along and got worse from the day the Senate censured him when he essentially became a down-and-out alcoholic.
So what are the lessons of Joe McCarthy that we can apply 70 years later to get us out of our current situation?
So I'd like to end with an upbeat note. The lesson of Joe McCarthy is we've talked about the story of bullying and demagoguery and how sad it is that time and again, in the way that happened with the archetypal bully Joe McCarthy, we've seen bullies emerge in our politics and we've bought into them. But in the end, it's a good news story. And the good news is that given the rope every demagogue in American history has hung themselves, and given the time, America has seen through every bully and rediscovered its better nature.
I like that. That's a good way to look at things. It is a terrific book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Larry, thank you so much for your great work on this, and thanks again for joining us.
Love being with you. Thank you very much.